Hey,
what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a good recording, man.
Yeah, brother, like, solid. Right on.
All right, welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. It's you know, my colleague, is that the right term?
Sure. don't spell that with a K either, right now.
Want to welcome back a good friend, none other than Mr. Sandy Williams. Hey, good morning to you, Sandy. How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, it's Friday. That's always a good feeling.
Come on, Sandy.
I got this far.
What does it matter whether it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or January 1st or December 31st to a guy like you who's been retired for?
You like to keep track on the cave. I make a little niche on the cave wall every morning when I wake up.
Hey, I mean, really, I'm kind of like you. It doesn't matter whether it's Monday or Friday or, you know, Sunday, but
yeah, every day's a good day.
Yeah, but what it does matter, and you know what does matter, is the time of the year. And man, we got a long slog ahead of us.
Well, we do. Winter, you know, this is like an old-fashioned winter. I can remember when I was, you know, in the 1950s, you'd wake up to these kind of days, and now we're back, this polar vortex thing. Yesterday, I was driving along at 4:30. The moon was out. The sun was down. I mean, this is winter, right?
Yeah.
It's dark for 14 hours a day, and it's cold.
Well, you know, Sandy, we really got spoiled. What was it they were talking about that made winter shorter and warmer and global warming? Where is that?
Yeah, well, this is actually what's happening now. They think is the result of global warming, this so-called polar vortex, where the polar cap on the top of the world gets pushed down by the warming of the Arctic. So the Arctic area is actually warmer than normal, and this cold toupee that lives on the top of the Earth has slid down over our eyes, and so now it's slid down into North Central United States, and however, some parts of the rest of the world are a good deal warmer than normal as a result.
You know, my friend, you have a lot of connections. Can you do anything to expedite this winter?
Yeah, I think we'd have to talk to Leo from Chicago. Oh, yeah. I mean, his connections are better than mine.
You know, Sandy, I will say this: we had become spoiled. This is the way winter used to be.
This is all right. This is exciting.
Right. What's all right about
this? This is exciting. This is a challenge. This brings out the frontier spirit that drove our ancestors to live in places like Wisconsin.
Hey, Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
There's some things I don't mind taking on the challenge, but you know, living on a glacier is not one of them.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, we'll get down to business a bit. This cold winter is going to feel a lot colder, to the extent that this question of whether people can afford their monthly paychecks, can afford their monthly bills with their monthly paychecks, is becoming obviously a dicey issue for lots of Americans. And it's much dicier when it's 0 degrees outside.
Well, you know, Sandy, when it's cold like this, it becomes a challenge for people to pay their heating bills, especially people who rent places that aren't sealed.
Right.
That don't have. And you know, we're talking about affordability. I was listening to the president and his minions the other day, Sandy, and they were trying to make us believe that things are better. and since he's been in office and since they've been running things. And when people pointed out to them the things that weren't really good, they keep going back to this pat answer, Joe Biden. How long are they going to be able to use Joe Biden and the Democrats, Sandy?
Well, you know, the problems with affordability, I've been thinking about this and sort of looking at numbers, and this has been something that's been creeping up on us for decades. And some of it has been creeping up on us because of government inaction or government actions which have actually exacerbated the problem rather than improved it. And people tend to talk about gasoline prices and grocery prices, because that's the kind of stuff that they have to reach into their pocket and pay for every day. But the really big chunks of money that people are facing that they can ill afford, in addition to utilities, which have gone up a great deal, the cost of heating and the cost of electricity. But the big things are the cost of housing generally and the cost of health care generally. And, you know, we had a major crisis in this country, a financial crisis in 2007, when the housing industry, which everyone is involved with in some fashion, fell apart because of a bubble that had occurred there. And I had lunch yesterday with a fellow who's quite an expert in the healthcare area, and he was worrying about the collapse of the healthcare industry and the collapse which might be precipitated, like something like this huge increase in health insurance premiums that might happen in the next week or two if steps aren't taken, and what that could do to the healthcare industry. Because, Earl, who's the biggest employer in Wisconsin? Do you know?
Yeah, the healthcare industry. Right.
And if you went around to every state in the country, you'd find out that healthcare is one of the biggest employers in just about every state. And in the city of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee region, some of the biggest employers are the hospitals here. And yet, you know, you pick up the newspaper and read about various hospitals. The Ascension Hospital system has been in the news media a fair amount for the notion that maybe they're teetering a bit in terms of having trouble meeting financial requirements. And if we end up with many people not being able to afford health insurance, so we have many more uninsured people showing up at hospitals for health care with nobody to pay the bill but the hospital to absorb it, you can end up with potentially a potential collapse of our medical system. Because, as you mentioned in one of our earlier podcasts, these hospitals are building out like mad. You know, they're expending money on the expectation that there will always be someone there to pay the check and pay the bill when somebody comes in and needs medical care. And we've got health care requirements that are developing very rapidly for our aging population. So, you know, that's a problem. And we can talk later about the housing trends too, but there's serious trends associated with housing that need to be addressed in some fashion. And we don't have people in Washington, particularly the current administration, facing up to these issues at all. The health care is, you know, the notion that we extend the subsidies for health insurance for another year or two is hardly an answer to solving the notion that the United States spends 20% of its GDP on health care and no other country spends anything like that on it. What? We need to be addressing health care at its roots and make sure that, number one, everybody has access to it, and number two, that it doesn't break the bank in terms of our economy.
Well, you know, Sandy, you speak, and not tongue in cheek, about the possibility of the collapse of the healthcare system. If we could take a walk into the future, a collapse of the American healthcare system means a collapse of the economy of the United States, doesn't it?
Well, that's my point. You know, people talk about recessions, and they always, you know, talk about whether it's going to happen. And recessions typically happen when something unforeseen or something that people haven't been talking about happens. And that's what happened in 2007 with the major recession, the housing bubble that people weren't talking about, but which they talked about after the fact, like, oh, yeah, we should have seen that coming. When that burst in a fashion that almost broke our financial system, it was a big problem. People now are talking about whether people have access to health care, but they aren't talking about the flip side of that, which is, what about the health care system and this huge employer in our economy? What happens if something happens to them as the result of the fracture of the ability of people to pay their health care bills? And so I think that that's really what's going to be the tipping thing, that that's maybe going to cause everyone to wake up and realize we've got to roll up our sleeves and look at healthcare from top to bottom, because it's a huge employer. You know, with, in 1960, the biggest employers in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee were manufacturers,
right?
Alice Chalmers and big companies that were located here. And now if you look at the top 10 employers in the Milwaukee metro area in Wisconsin, most of them are in the healthcare industry.
You know, Sandy, you talk about you know, the possibility of this collapse. Clearly, Congress people know this. They know the impact of it. Yet they're still fiddling while Rome burns. I mean, here's the bottom line. I've been listening to whether or not they're going to extend the subsidies, and they're still right back where they were before the shutdown. So they're going to continue to play this game, Sandy. Apparently, the risk that you are talking about don't seem to be as dire in their eyes. Or do you think that they can't foresee what you kind of pointed out as inevitable?
No, I think both they and I think the hospital system maybe is looking at things through rose-colored glasses as well, because all of the discussion is about the patients, the potential patients who will have health problems and won't have health insurance for it, and their capacity to pay for it or not. But when you think about it, the flip side of that is if they can't pay for it, then the person who provided it doesn't get paid for it. And you end up with the potential for, you know, how does a hospital system save money? Well, about the only way they save money is with massive layoffs of personnel. Well, what causes recessions in the economy is massive losses of jobs, in particularly in places where many people are employed. And so, you know, I've sort of woke up this morning with a different view of this healthcare problem. I've, from an empathetic and compassionate standpoint, I'm very worried about the people who need to be insured and need to have access to healthcare. And that's the fundamental thing that most people ought to be worried about. But I'm also very worried about a healthcare system that might be way overextended and would be in a position of great calamity in the circumstance in which many people aren't insured and can't pay their bills.
So,
because not being insured doesn't keep you from getting sick.
So, Sandy, just to corroborate for a moment what you were saying about the 1960s and today in Milwaukee. And this is just Milwaukee, but this is probably the same all over this nation, only, you know, different cities. In 1970, the 10 largest employers in Milwaukee, Alex Chalmers, A.O. Smith, Briggs & Stratton, AC Electronics, Harness Vega, American Motors, Slits, Pabst Miller. The 10 largest employers in 2004, Sandy, 34 years later, Aurora Healthcare, Covenant Healthcare, We Energies, GE Healthcare, Columbia St. Mary's. And then fast forward to 2021, Sandy, Milwaukee's 10 largest employers in 2021, Advocate Aurora Health, Frederick Health Inc., Ascension Wisconsin, Medical College of Wisconsin, GE Healthcare, Children's Hospital. It's exactly what you just mentioned. And I'm sure it's that way all over the nation, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's what's trending in every well, look, 20% of our GDP is expended in the healthcare fields. So that means that Probably. If you just put a linear relationship between dollars and employment, 20% of the people employed in this country are probably employed in something related to healthcare, or it could even be a larger number than that, because they might not be average wage employees. So it is a very big segment of our economy, and it's one which people ought to be worried about from the standpoint of compassion and empathy and human rights, but they also ought to be worried about it from the standpoint of economic welfare and the capacity of our economy to thrive, and it's something that needs to be looked at, needs to be addressed. You know, Barack Obama tried to take a big look at it, and the lobbies that existed ended up with the production of something that looked more like sausage in terms of legislation, which was the Obamacare program. And the Obamacare program was fundamentally based on a mandate that everyone participated, and the opponents to it couldn't wait to try and eliminate that part of it, which sort of was the linchpin to its success.
So we have a
general consensus apparently as a country that pre-existing conditions ought to be not to be a bar to being covered, that everyone ought to have access to health care in some fashion, but we seem to have a complete logjam in terms of the intellectual process, the political process of evaluating what we do to our health care system to make it actually work.
So, Sandy, the worst part of it is you and I can't do anything to fix it. Right? I mean, the people who we have in office right now are at the vanguard. They're the ones who need to make this happen. I think the American people don't understand the complexities. I know the American people don't understand the complexities. I know I have no concept at all about how healthcare works. And
join the army there, because I think even people in the healthcare industry are mystified by the Byzantine aspects of how all the various payors work and the various parts of the process for bundling insurance, bundling the healthcare providers, bundling the pharmaceuticals that people use. It's an unbelievably Byzantine process that was created by a bunch of special interests not necessarily coordinating with one another.
You know, Sandy, we talked about healthcare, I think, maybe the last time or maybe the time before that. But it doesn't go away, because everything is tied. The budget of our nation is tied into it. You know,
you looked at some numbers from 1960 about employment. In 1960, the average annual premiums paid to Blue Cross per family was approximately $144 to cover health care annually. And
annual.
And in 2020. The cost was $25,436 annually for a family of four, including deductibles. So in spite of whatever, the $144, if you inflate that to today's dollars, would be $1,300. So what we've had is about a 2,000% increase here, and it's just a crazy level of increase in the cost.
Let me ask you, Sandy, because again, I always go back to, and you go back to it a lot too, about that the employer used to cover that for us without paying any deductible. During my lifetime,
right,
as a young person and the youthful working years that I had, we didn't pay any deductible as it related to our employer covered the whole thing, lock, stock, and barrel. It was all negotiated.
Right.
And now if the employers have a package that they offer, but man, probably in some instances 25% of what you're getting paid or more goes towards the insurance.
Yeah, I mean, the cost of insurance to the employer has become a big problem. And if this if this Obamacare subsidization is dropped, and if the number of insureds goes way down, the people who will experience this big cost increase in insurance premiums will not just be individuals who are insured. It'll also be the employers who are buying the 50% of the insurance coverage. In many places now, the employer will pay 50 or 75% of the cost of health insurance, and the employee will pay a portion of the premiums as well, and they're and a deductible, so that's a way of spreading the cost between the employer and the employee. But that cost to the employer is going to go way up too, and which is a burden on our economy and on the expenses of every business that increases their payroll cost.
So, Sandy, are we relying on, you know, somebody to find religion to fix this? Or I would ask you, what would be the rationale for the people who are making money off of this to cut back and do the right thing?
Well, that's the problem. It's so Byzantine that there are all kinds of people making plenty of money who are making it from opposite sides of the table. They aren't really necessarily cooperating with one another. They're just winning in the system because the system has been designed by them for them to do particularly well. So the people who make pharmaceuticals do well. The people who make medical implements and instruments do well. The people who do diagnostic imaging and that kind of things, they do well. The hospitals have worked it out in terms of how they recover their costs from insurers. You know, it's just a very complex marketplace in which many people are operating in sort of the shade, or at least a partial darkness from the public, who all have their hand out in the process of taking a slice of the cost of medical care. And the sum total of this has been that the American system, while we have generated the capacity to provide very sophisticated medical care, is one of the least accessible systems to the people who live here, number one. And number two, it consumes a higher percentage of our GDP by a large number in terms of a percentage as compared to any other developed country. I think Germany might have something like 12% consumed by healthcare costs. We have 20. So that's a very big burden on the economy.
So, Sandy, you're a free market guy. Is this an instance where the free market can't be regulated or and so it's not going to regulate itself?
Well, the design of this system was not designed by a marketplace. This was designed sort of, like I said, when we talked about it, by someone backing into a cactus in terms of, and then a bunch of political lobbies that have designed it over time. But my fear is that we aren't going to get the attention of the politicians to actually roll up their sleeves and evaluate this at the ground level until they get hit upside the head with a board, much like I guess you get the attention of a donkey. But and I'm afraid that board that's going to hit them is going to have to be some calamity, some maybe economic calamity that's precipitated by this Byzantine system.
Yeah,
because all they're talking about now are Band-Aids.
But Sandy, go ahead.
Well, the Band-Aid that we talk about now is the subsidization. And that subsidization is necessary primarily because the mandate didn't survive, and so the Obamacare insurance programs are not benefited by having universal participation in the insurance pools, which would have driven down the cost of insurance. So now we have kind of the worst possible in terms of the outcome. People want to point at Obamacare and blame it. That isn't really the culprit. The culprit is that Obamacare was robbed of its linchpin of the mandate, which then crippled it. But we still had the problem, and we still have the problem, of a third party in payor process that's dependent on the private insurance industry, and we end up with the outcome we have.
You know, Sandy, the power tricksters getting hit upside the head with the board is no consolation for the American people, because that means total collapse.
Well, unfortunately, that's been a lesson we've learned over time, right? I mean, the housing industry and was doing what it was doing, and it was kind of running wild and ran amok, and we got hit upside the head with a board. But when the board that hits doesn't hit a politician upside the head, it actually hits the economy. It hits Tom, Dick, and Mary.
Right.
And then the politicians realize they have to do something about it. And I fear that that's what's going to happen now, is that we're toying with two different segments of the economy: housing, which is immensely expensive, and we aren't really spending much time trying to address the solutions to it. And we can talk about some of the trends that have created it. The finger we can point at the housing problem is probably just society and the evolution of our culture. But it still ends up being the case that housing has become enormously more expensive today than it was. And a primary culprit for that is the fact that in 1960, the average household included 3.33 people. And in 2020, the average household includes 2.5 people. And so it takes 33% more housing units to house the same population. In today's 342 million population in the United States, with 2.5 people in each household, it takes 137 million units. And if we had the 3.33 people per household as we did in 1960, it would only take about 102 million units. So we need 35 million more housing units today for the size of our population than we would have needed for the same population in 1960. And that puts a tremendous burden, a cost burden, on the housing industry. And it also creates a great deal of demand for housing, which drives its price up. So, okay, that's the cause. We aren't going to force people to live together to get that household number back up to 3.33. But we do need to address, in some fashion, making housing more affordable, because housing costs today cost about $25,000 annually on average for a family. And in the 1960 period, that number was a tenth of that. Okay, and so if you take healthcare at $25,000 and housing costs at $25,000, that's $50,000 out of the $67,000 median income, which is, unsustainable. So we've got a couple of trends here that need to be addressed, need to be focused upon, and it isn't with a Band-Aid, and it isn't with some ideological answer like let's cut out the subsidy and let people fend for themselves.
Now you're talking about housing and the price of housing, that really, when you're looking at what the increase is in the amount that people are being paid, the Trump administration is touting how, things have, people are making more money since he's been in office, and things have really increased for the average person. Yet the price of housing continues to escalate. You know, Sandy, we're in a situation almost of no return. Not enough housing. The lack of housing means the price of housing is going to continue to soar. And so less and less people making enough money. I mean, it's really kind of a bad omen for the future, Sandy.
Well, in fact, in 2025, actually, the household size went from 2.5 to 2.6, and then that was so it went up a little bit. And you know what the explanation was?
What?
The adult children of couples were moving back home because they couldn't afford a housing unit when they got done with college or got done with their training. And so more and more families are finding adult children living at home, which is increasing the housing, the number of people living in the household. But it's only because household costs have become so high. And that's just, it's an interesting barometer to look at, to realize the extent to which now the cost of housing is driving us culturally in a new direction.
So, Sandy, there are no quick fixes to any of these things we're discussing right now. You're not going to be able to click a switch on and move things. It's going to take people sitting down for years and bit by bit kind of working this through. Is it safe to say that?
Well, yeah, you know, government is sort of the way that that individuals in a nation deal with shared problems and try to figure out the solution to their shared problems. And, you know, the marketplace drives housing. But everybody in this country is experiencing a shared problem of the cost of housing. Everyone in this country is experiencing a shared problem of the cost and access to health care. And what we need now is for people to decide that, I think, that government does provide value in the from the standpoint of potentially being the vehicle for solving shared problems. And what we need are people who will now drop some of the ideological barriers they might have to, number one, saying, yes, actually, government might be able to do some good here. We have to examine how it is they might do it. And number two, let's roll up our sleeves, figure out what the problems are with respect to our healthcare costs and access to it and our housing costs, and figure out whether there's something that government could, should, or would do, and should we have a government do these things that might help mitigate or solve the problems. But that's not the way we're currently built in this country. We seem to be identifying the problem, jumping up and down about it, blaming the other side for the problem without discussing the solutions that might be brought to bear on the problems. And I think this could sober America up and say, you know what, maybe government can be the vehicle for a discussion about, an analysis of, and potentially the development of solutions for these very serious problems.
So, Sandy, But, you know, look, clearly one side says government is too big. We need to pare government down. The other side says government is important. And in many instances, people say that the government went too far in trying to spoon feed the American people. There's got to be something somewhere where people decide, okay, the wealthiest amongst us we cut their burdens financially, and which helped support government. And then there's another side of it where, you know, people understand we kind of need health care. People can't afford to do it. Government plays a role in it. How do you fix that, Sandy?
Well, let's take health care and let's look at the way various parties have addressed it. You know, there was a time when the Democratic Party wanted to address health care at its basis and figure out, you know, should we have the government providing health care insurance for all, the whole so-called Medicare for all
right.
solution. And that still is, however, premised on a third-party payor system. But so we've had a willingness at some level to roll up our sleeves and go back to something closer to ground base, a zero-based position to reanalyze our system. But ultimately, that has turned into a debate about whether we ought to subsidize those people who can't afford the cost of this way too expensive system, and therefore we ought to put money in their pocket or at least subsidize the cost of the premiums they pay so they can afford it. The other side is saying we don't like subsidies. We think subsidies drive prices up, but they aren't willing to roll up their sleeves and do anything about the insurance industry and the system that is, in fact, the basis for driving the price up. And the result of those two positions are, if they don't pay the subsidy, then the price of insurance is going to go way up because the size of the insurance pools is going to go down. The number of participants in the insurance pool is going to go down. The price of insurance, therefore, for everyone is going to go up. And there are going to be many fewer people who have access to health care insurance, or at least can pay for the health care, that they are able to get by walking into an emergency room. And so, you know, right now we've got sort of a dysfunctional approach because no one's willing to take on, I guess, the lobbies of the insurance industry and the various lobbies that have helped build this. You know, it's like building an elephant in the dark, and it doesn't look anything like an elephant in terms of what's been created for our healthcare system.
Here, Sandy, you just, this is something that I've always never really understood, and it's always peeved me off. The lobbyists, nobody's willing to take on the lobbyists. Well, elected officials aren't willing to take on the lobbyists. We elect them to do our bidding, Sandy. We can't deal with any of those things. The way our system
When I say lobbyists, it's probably not quite a fair way to describe. They're not willing to take on the status quo. Because what the status quo involves is tens of thousands of people employed who are vested in and are basically there because of the design of our healthcare system. And so, you know, the 20% of our GDP that's consumed, some of that is hospitals, maybe 14, I don't know what percentage of, let's say 14% of it is hospitals and direct kinds of healthcare, but 6% of it might well be the insurance industry and the people who are involved with this Byzantine structure associated with how we deliver healthcare. That's lots of employees, and those employees all vote in districts. And when lobbyists show up in a congressman's office to talk to them, they usually are able to color an argument that's based on the interests of the constituents of the congressman. So they'll, you know, if the defense industry will point an Oshkosh truck up in Oshkosh when they're talking to the Oshkosh congressman. The hospital industry will point at these tens of thousands of people employed by hospitals in Wisconsin when they're talking to congressmen. The insurance industry will do the same thing. And so what's difficult is for our political process to take on a status quo which has such a substantial vested position in our economy that it is 20% of the economy.
Okay, so Sandy, and so at the root of this is you and I lived at a time when this wasn't a major issue. So it worked. And so now it's not working. And now it's almost a total collapse. So something happened in between, Sandy, it working, because they didn't totally change the system, right?
The system worked. The system evolved. And what happened was that post-World War II, for every decade, this cost of health care, once we ended up with Medicare and Medicaid, and we ended up with hospitals being able to realize payment for every kind of efficacious treatment that could be devised, we developed our highly sophisticated capacity to deliver health care because we had this ability to get paid for every kind of sophisticated apparatus or every sophisticated kind of, and expensive kind of treatment that could be invented. And so over those decades, we went from simple chest x-rays to very complex MRIs, CTs, all kinds of things that were developed that were far more expensive than what we were getting treated with in 1955. And so the cost of healthcare escalated dramatically as it became more sophisticated and as we developed the notion that everybody was entitled to every kind of efficacious health care that you could get. regardless of its cost. And so that's what we now have in the United States, and it's getting paid for through a healthcare system that doesn't have an incentive to try and negotiate lower prices in a very rigorous way with any of the providers or with any of the people who provide the equipment or the treatment systems.
So you just pointed out a problem, Sandy, that can only be fixed by the people who are not willing to fix it.
That's why I'm afraid that it's going to be that board upside the head. It's going to, particularly in with something that's as vested in our economy as the healthcare system we have, which accounts for 20% of our GDP, and similarly, the housing industry, which is not particularly regulated or involved with the government, we have a healthcare, a housing shortage, and a housing cost problem that it can only be solved probably fundamentally by a marketplace which moves rather slowly, and which will probably drive all kinds of cultural changes as well. People right now are moving from some cities to other cities to find more affordable housing. And the cities they're moving to are finding their housing becoming less affordable. I've got a sister who lives in Bozeman, Montana. That used to be a backwater town in Montana that was, maybe visited sometimes by people who were outdoor enthusiasts.
Right.
Yeah. Now $4 million will buy you a nice house. Lots of people have moved there and have driven the price of housing up. And so housing is a phenomena that's particularly complex, but I think it needs to be recognized that it's a big part of the affordability problem, and it's hard to point your finger at this politician or that politician, but you'd like to see the government looking at it and trying to figure out if there's a way that it can participate in solving it.
Well, also, Sandy, I refuse to believe that a nation as powerful as ours that can develop the kind of military apparatus that we develop and the amount of money in the face of all the other things that we continue to put into that we can't figure out or understand that making sure the American people are housed has to become a priority. I don't, for the life of me, Sandy, those kind of things, I just don't understand.
Well, housing and much of that has been left to locales to try and figure out solutions.
I know, but our government's got to do that.
Yeah, and I am just saying that you would hope that government would be looking at and trying to figure out the ways in which it can participate most successfully and most effectively to solve the problems of housing shortage as well as housing costs and housing availability. And in that respect, cost and availability are the same kind of issues in healthcare. And of course, two of the fundamental human needs that you'd think the government would want to recognize are shelter, housing, and healthcare. And you'd think a developed country like the United States would therefore put these front and center. But we seem to duck from both of them.
Hey, Sandy, several months ago, in Milwaukee, a family of seven children were living out of a storage facility. I don't know if you remember that. They were living out of a storage facility because they couldn't afford to live anywhere else. And so the family was condemned. How dare they? How can they do such a thing? But Sandy, we've got families homeless. Not individuals anymore, but that number is only going to continue to escalate, Sandy, if this is not prioritized.
Yeah, I mean, there are some cities where homelessness and homelessness on the streets is a recognized substantial problem. And of course, some of that is sociological and some of that is economic. But I just am surprised that our politicians are willing to fight over the things they fight over rather than rolling up their sleeves and actually working on solving the problems that both, you know, the healthcare thing is going to be a big problem for our economy. It's going to be a big problem for the people who have piles of money, as well as for the people who have no money. And the problem in the economy that a disaster of the healthcare industry could cause is potentially going to cause people with piles of money to lose piles of money. And so, you know, I think if people were smart, they would start addressing fundamental issues, and particularly fundamental issues with broad effects in our economy. They would focus on them and not take their eye off the ball to the extent they have, and not get diverted by issues that are foreign to us, literally, by thousands of miles, and also foreign to us in terms of having a capacity to know what's going on.
You know, Sandy, I was listening to the president on yesterday or the day before, whenever it was, and he was talking about how the price of prescription drugs had gone down in many instances 200-300%. And the thing that galls me is the price of medication, Sandy, that the American people pay, when in a lot of instances, all of the research that's done for a lot of these medications come from taxpayer dollars.
Well, and, I think the problem with someone who would declare that prices have gone down 200-300%, which is, you're right, that's what he said, is that they don't know anything about numbers, apparently.
that's
if it goes down 100%, it's free. And if it goes down 200%, they're paying you to take it. And if it goes down 300%, they're paying you double. And so this notion that affordability is a scam is just proof that some people are totally detached from the reality that Tom, Dick, and Mary face. Because if you look at the cost of housing, and if you look at the cost of health care, and then layer on top of that what might be happening to the cost of groceries or things that escalate, and incidentally, the cost of health care to Tom, Dick, and Mary, yes, pharmaceuticals can be a big part of that. But they aren't the biggest part of that.
Right.
And they aren't the thing that break the bank for Tom, Dick, and Mary, typically, unless it's chemotherapy or some of the things that have just enormous prices. But, trying to persuade the American public that we are not heading in the direction of a very tight economy in which things are much palpably much less affordable than they used to be is to defy reality. And I think that's you can't talk people out of something that they actually understand and feel every day.
You know, Sandy, not only is the healthcare system broken, not only is the educational system broken, not only is the housing system broken, it almost appears that our nation itself is headed down a path that, you know, if it's not prioritized, and we get away from the politics, but I guess we can't get away from the politics because that's, you know, apparently that's more, you know, important than the realities that people are faced with. Do you think that those who are in government, you spent some time in government, do you think that they don't feel the pain of their constituents, or they're so far removed from them?
It's kind of like when you have a desk and you've put stuff up in the corner of your desk to do later.
They never get to it.
And some of those things that you put up in the corner are really complicated, and you're not sure you know how to solve those things. And some of the other things are much easier to do. So what's the priority? What do? Well, you end up doing the easy things, and you keep pushing those things that are hard
right
back up in the corner. And then if you have brush fires that you have to deal with day to day, if you can have a fight over what's going on in offshore Venezuela, and if that can become a major fire, and not that that isn't a very important issue, but if you have firestorms going on all the time, those things that get pushed up in the corner of your desk that are complicated never get addressed. And that's really what ends up being the case, particularly with healthcare. The solutions to healthcare are complicated, and they also involve disrupting a status quo that consumes 20% of our GDP. And so that's very difficult and complicated. And so it's people avoid it, and they avoid it today, they avoid it tomorrow, they've been avoiding it for decades. And the same is kind of true for housing. Housing is a difficult problem to get around. It's basically a massive market. The government can't control the market, so the government has to decide how it can try and affect the market, and also how it can try and provide access to housing for those who can't afford it. And that's also kind of a complex issue. And so it goes up on the corner of the desk, and everything else that's a flashpoint that's either more fun to deal with, easier to deal with, or is getting more public attention in the moment, it gets dealt with.
You know, Sandy, it's a good assessment. I mean, what you just pointed out, without question, is probably what is happening. But that can't be acceptable, man. We're talking about people, right? We're talking about the American people, and they're not invisible, Sandy, right? Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I think the American people have to get up on that corner of the desk and be standing there on top of the pile, making it the most significant thing. I mean, that's the only reason it's stalled up there on the corner is the American public as well doesn't really know how to do anything but let them malinger about it. They aren't forcing their hand. Politicians basically, I mean, I knew this from Pat Lucy, when I was his legal counsel, told me that someone very wise told him, never solve a problem until you have to. And that's kind of the political way politicians operate. Never address a problem and solve it until it's put before you in a manner that requires that you deal with it. And so, you know, I think that's the problem. These two issues do not get put before politicians in a manner that requires them to solve it.
So let me ask you, Sandy, wasn't once upon a time that's where the media came in? And even before the media had as many outlets as it has now, 24-hour news cycles, you know, that when we had 6-4 and 12 and Chet Huntley and Chet, I forgot what his name is.
Chet Huntley.
Yeah, and those guys, they were able to speak for the American people straight to the Congress, only a handful of them, and get these things addressed.
Well, you know, until they were able to do it on a bunch of things, but not on complicated things. Our healthcare system evolved under their nose. The problem was that the healthcare system was working, and then it was working, and it was working. And it wasn't until the 1990s that employers began to run the numbers and figured out that the trend line for the cost of healthcare and the way they were providing it as a benefit was gonna break their back. And so they started shifting it onto the employees and trying to find ways to avoid it. So, I would say that the lack of an organized media has made us less able to have a good political attention span. But I think these problems were fundamental from the beginning. And it was just that the Americans embarked on a system of employee-provided, insurance-covered health care subsequent to World War II, when all the rest of the world was going in a different direction. And we went in that direction and have been going in that direction until now. And now we're finding that it's filled with problems.
You know, Sandy, Dr. King talked about two separate Americas, and you know, many years ago. And it is even more, you know, you can see it even brighter today. that they, these two separate Americas, the middle class, Sandy, that used to be kind of a buffer, we know that that middle class now, as you stated, you know, you call them Tom, Dick, and Mary, their situation's not getting any better.
No, Tom, Dick, and Mary have gone from being able to save money and buy snowmobiles and what have you to living paycheck to paycheck.
Okay.
And the fact is that the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, a whole bunch of news media sources have tried to figure out what it takes to live without financial fear. What level of income does it take? And the number has been surprisingly high in every metropolitan area. I mean, the number exceeds $100,000 for a family in most metropolitan areas if you're going to try and live without essentially financial fear day to day. And by financial fear, I mean living paycheck to paycheck, unable to save, unable to cover all your costs.
So, Sandy, let me say this to you and the listening audience. Middle-class America, which has not had to deal with that kind of stress, let's be honest, what we're talking about is stress.
Yeah.
There are people who were beneath the middle class who have dealt with this kind of life throughout generations. And what helped support it and what helped to support them was government and some programs that would kind of make it possible, Sandy, that they wouldn't be homeless or that they could get some health care or that they could, there'd be some sustenance, there'd be schools because they didn't make enough money to pay the taxes to keep those things going. You add in a lot of people from the middle class, Sandy, and then the top earners paying less in taxes. It's a recipe for a failure.
Well, it's definitely a recipe for some big problems, and some of them are economic. But when economic problems get too big, you end up with social and
right.
cultural problems as well. And so, you know, we could be headed there. Maybe on our next podcast, we can talk about some of those things. But
Let me go here, Sandy. I was listening to the president again the other day when he was talking with his cabinet. And Sandy, it doesn't work when you can hand pick what news outlets you want, right? I mean, this is what's taking place. It's not a free and open press. And so, you know, the conversation was about how many different how employment is doing. We've hired more people, and you can say anything, Sandy. It doesn't make it so.
Well, you know, I think another subject for discussion will be the discussion of the point of the importance of debate and dissent
right.
in a society, and whether the loss of debate and dissent from a society isn't a terribly dangerous phenomena, which threatens all kinds of things, including threaten it economically in terms of the economic vibrance of a country, because non-dissent probably means that you begin to deviate from facts and reality to a greater and greater extent. And to the extent that you get off the beam on facts and reality, you can get pretty far off into Never Never Land in a way that's quite dangerous.
Did you ever, once, and you've been around the sun a time or two like I have, ever thought that our nation could wind up where she is right now?
Well, I have to say, it all feels different than I ever expected things to feel here. And so, you know, I maybe there's a bunch of other people feeling the same way now, and
yeah.
I don't know. but I'm still optimistic. I think that reality sets in for people, and it takes different things to create the reality in their mind. But I think we're seeing more and more of people who believe that it's important to stay the course and deal with reality and deal with facts. And if we do that, we'll get more and more people paying attention to things like healthcare and housing.
Well, you know, Sandy, one of the things that I enjoy so much in having a conversation and dialogue with you is that, you know, we really get into the weeds in these subjects. And with your vast knowledge of things, you know, I watch a lot of the talking heads and those kinds of things, and, you know, they have a couple minutes to discuss a subject. We don't do that. We kind of delve deep into the subject matters, and that's why we don't need to have 20 different subjects that we talk about. And I think in the long run, Sandy, that's a good way to approach things, because as you stated, all this stuff is complicated, right?
It's easy to develop adult ADHD, you know, attention deficit disorder, and I'm afraid that we've got too much of that going nationally. But I think if we started paying attention to and trying to prioritize what's really important and then focus on it, we can get back to a reality that's more effective and more functional.
It's always good to have the dialogue with you, my friend. We're going to keep on doing it. That's it. That's a wrap.